Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 5th of June. Our guest this hour says it is imperative that we return Congress to something more closely resembling the institution she joined in 1979. Clearly, there is something terribly wrong in Washington. Former United States Senator Olympia Snowe is our guest this hour, and she has a new book, Fighting for Common Ground, How We Can Fix the Stalemate in Congress. She served in the U.S. Congress for 34 years, a three-term senator from Maine, elected to the State House of Representatives in 73 when she was a mere 26 years old, and to the Senate in Maine in 1976. Last year, she founded Olympia's List, which recognizes and supports elected officials and candidates who demonstrate their commitment to solving our nation's problems. She also is working as a senior fellow at the Bipartisan Policy Center. She spends some time, well, it's a fascinating book, but she looks at this period, and I do want her to highlight that in some detail, when the whole economy seemed to be about to implode, the stimulus was taking place, and then a move into health care reform, and she said that it really solidified some Republican opposition to the new president and led to formation of Tea Party groups that became very active. But she was maneuvering all of that because she was being wooed, as you'll recall, by the president, by Democrats, and she was very much involved in bipartisan groups of legislators because that's who she has been, to work out some kind of compromise. But as she says, you don't get a badge of honor for working with the other side these days. So we'll be welcoming phone calls for her as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. She also offers a blueprint of how we can change Congress. Maybe people ought to work 5 days a week. Maybe there should be no pay unless there's a budget. Filibuster reform, a bipartisan leadership committee she calls for, a more open amendment process. So we have a whole lot to talk about as we welcome former senator from the state of Maine, Olympia Snowe. Hello.
Hello. Hi.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, absolutely, Kathleen. Thank you for having me today. I appreciate it very much.
Yeah, I found the book absolutely fascinating. And I want to start, if you don't mind, with this whole time, and you write about it in some detail. When the president had just been elected, the economy was about to implode. There was a great debate about a stimulus. And then we moved into health care reform. And you, Senator Olympia Snowe, were very much involved in that whole process. It sort of brings together the divisions that became worse, the lack of compromise, perhaps the Democrats going too far. And there you were, front and center, and everybody wanted your vote. And people wanted to hear what you had to say. And a lot of things became worse during that time in terms of division, don't you think?
Yes, absolutely. I think obviously it began with the stimulus, regrettably, because both sides actually agreed on the imperative of developing a stimulus plan to revive the economy. It was still on the verge, you know, of collapsing. I mean, we had already gone through the TARP process with the previous administration right before the election of 2008. But even in the aftermath, it was in a tenuous position. So in order to revive it, it required a stimulus. The question was how much and what should be the content of that stimulus legislation. And ultimately, I say that sort of the wheels came off so soon in a process with the new administration, with President Obama, and obviously a new Congress, that they weren't able to work together on this, you know, became probably, other than health care, one of the single greatest initiatives that Congress enacted.
You talk about the stimulus bill perhaps having measures that weren't stimulus measures. You brought those to whose attention, and what do you think should have been done that would have been more stimulus-related?
Yes, I think that first, I think initially it's how the original stimulus plan was drafted. It began in the House of Representatives and was drafted by the Democratic majority, and they went forward and they included a number of provisions that would otherwise have been, I think, more relevant to the appropriations process on a year-to-year basis, but not stimulative in nature. I mean, they were basically funding, you know, programs that already existed or expanding them, but not necessarily stimulative. basically the definition of stimulus is being temporary, timely, and targeted. And it did meet all of those definitions. So I did bring a list to the president when I first met with him. In fact, as I recall, I was the first Republican to meet with the president on this question. And I gave him a list of $100 billion initially of provisions that really would not have been considered as stimulus. And so much of which, you know, we did ultimately were able to reduce, those of us who are Republicans that were working with him on the stimulus, which ultimately became three of us, did reduce the overall stimulus plan by $100 billion. But by that time, on our side, regrettably, they were not involved in the drafting stimulus because it already had gone through, that was working its way through the House already, and in the Senate, we were in the Finance Committee working on with tax provisions, and that was certainly should have included Republicans, and it did. But ultimately, it wasn't enough to satisfy the Republicans to work further to see what could be done to remove all the other issues that were problematic. And at that point, the stimulus was well underway with the Democratic majority, and they didn't want to make any adjustments. So it became a very contentious issue, as you know, and that spilled over to health care that consumed almost a year and a half.
It sure did. It was a long debate. You asked the question, and I was wondering what your answer might be. What if the president at that point in time had instead focused on job creation measures instead of health care reform? Do you still think that's what perhaps he should have done?
Yes, I do. I mean, I think that ultimately what occurred with the economy, it wasn't enough just to do the stimulus because the stimulus was temporary. It was really meant to sort of prop up the economy, get things going for a while until the private sector, had enough, confidence and strength to begin to make the investments to move forward. And that so the stimulus was a temporary bridge. We should have then pivoted to issues that I was arguing for at the time, such as tax reform, give certainty to the private sector, address regulatory reform, issues that ultimately could have swayed the private sector. Well, now is the time to make investments for the long term, knowing the certainty in these realms that are important to creating jobs and making investments and for companies to feel confident to doing that. So what happened was a vacuum that was created in that period of time because all of the oxygen, the political oxygen in Washington, was consumed by health care and to the exclusion of focusing on creating jobs. So it could have been a very different equation for the type of recovery that ultimately ensued. In fact, we had the weakest recovery in the aftermath of any recession in our history. I mean, that's unfortunate, but ultimately it became true because we didn't continue to do the things necessary to build up the private sector so that the environment was enough that create enough confidence to make the future investment.
Mm-hmm. And Senator Snow, it's not as though you haven't been vitally interested in health care issues. Heavens knows you've faced so many tragedies in your own life where health care had to be used. But what you looked at was whether or not, and I think this is a really important question that we still have to ask because states are debating what to do with people who don't have access to health care and don't make that much money. A lot of the working poor, will health insurance plans be affordable enough? The crucial question that you were asking, were people addressing that part of this? And do you think, with the Affordable Care Act, have health insurance plans that are affordable enough now?
Well, Kathleen, it's a good question, which is, you're absolutely right. As they mentioned in the book, that was one of the pivotal issues that I had focused on because I thought it was paramount that we have the answers to that question because in the exchanges, the plans that will be offered have to meet certain federal standards, which in many cases could be much higher, much greater, and more expanded than what, for example, current employers have for their employees or what employees prefer.
Mm-hmm.
In any event, I said we should do an analysis, and I had asked the Congressional Budget Office for analysis on a state-by-state basis because it will vary from state to state on the cost. And unfortunately, I was denied having that the answer to that question, and I thought it was critical and central because we don't know, and we still don't know, and particularly depends on how many people are in the exchange, how many insurance companies decide they want to offer plans in exchange, so how much competition there is. And, you know, the whole issue in healthcare is important because I did feel, and I didn't think it was enough to just stand in mute opposition to what the president was attempting to do on healthcare. I thought it was important to participate and contribute and to see where this journey ended and whether it was something I could support or not support. And ultimately, it wasn't because it became so big. But, you know, when I was chair of the Small Business Committee back in 2003, I was trying to get my side on the Republican side to support, you know, competitive health insurance plans by creating competition in the health insurance industry and allowing plans to be sold across state lines to offer competition. That would drive down rates. But even I couldn't get support from my side, which would have been a Republican idea. And we could have been maybe in a different place than we were, that ultimately led to where we are today on the whole issue of health care.
Yeah. You were, correct me if I'm wrong, weren't you in favor of a trigger mechanism?
You were right. I was. It was called a trigger for a public option, mm-hmm. which I think to this day I'm not quite sure why the Democratic majority was opposed to it, and many weren't. But obviously the leadership was, and I even have reporters asking me, they still could never, to this day, why it was never accepted. The trigger essentially would have been if plans in a given state didn't meet the affordability threshold that was determined by a formula that was incorporated in the amendments, then a public option would be triggered in that particular state so that you could ensure affordability. Because, again, it was an open question as to whether or not, you know, they'd have affordable health care plans. Well, they didn't accept that, which was interesting because they wanted the public option, which I thought would have diluted the ability to have competitive plans overall, frankly. But if you created the incentive for insurance companies to offer competitive plans to avoid the triggering of the public option, it's a different story. You're creating an incentive mm-hmm. for them to be competitive. But ultimately, it wasn't accepted. And I would have reporters, I did even to it just before I concluded my Senate term in December 2012, that reporters were saying they still couldn't figure out why the majority didn't agree to that, because to me it would have been a much more targeted approach, but it also would have created the impetus for competition among insurance plans and within the industry.
Mm-hmm. Well, now we have the situation, I'm not sure if you're familiar with what's going on in Wisconsin, but I am interested in your response to this, where there are some states who are not taking the Medicaid expansion money, and so there is a concern that there will be working poor in the state who evidently money's going to be given to hospitals, $75 million for emergency care for hospitals, but there is some question as to whether or not people will be able to afford health insurance if, you know, they're working a couple jobs and it's minimum wage. And so right. The very thing that you talked about hasn't fully been addressed here, which seems important, right?
It is all very important. That was the essence. Because, you know, when you have millions of Americans who are uninsured, we have a problem. And I've always felt it was a problem. In fact, when I ran for Congress initially in 78, I was talking about health insurance for the uninsured. And so here we are 3 decades later, and we're still debating the question, even mm-hmm. with the implementation of a new law. But the fact is, on the Medicaid expansion, you know, that was a key issue when I was in the Gang of Six in the Finance Committee, 3 Democrats and 3 Republicans, you know, working together to try to figure out a template for health care reform. And that was the central question on Medicaid expansion, to the degree to which you can compel states, you know, to offer Medicaid. And obviously the incentive was this 100% reimbursement. And states really have to make that decision about it. I had argued for putting these individuals into the exchange so that they have the ability to have access to those affordable health plans with subsidies. But that, you know, interestingly enough, would have become more expensive for the federal government and therefore decide on the Medicaid expansion. I was concerned about the level to which you would mandate the states to do that, but the 100% reimbursement was one way, I guess, of mitigating it. But I still had overriding concerns that states might resist that. And it's a problem now because
yes.
If these people aren't in, you know, part of the Medicaid expansion, they have to go to the exchange and can't afford it, where are they going to stand? Because we're talking about almost 17 million Americans that could be left out of the equation based on the Supreme Court ruling, for example, and what the states decide to do,
mm-hmm.
frankly. And it's one thing if you can offer them plans in the exchange. The question is, are they subsidized sufficiently given their level of income to have the ability to afford it?
We're going to take phone calls for you in just one moment. Just one more thing from me, and then we will pause for a moment and go to phone calls. Former Senator Olympia Snowe is our guest this hour. Her new book is Fighting for Common Ground, How We Can Fix the Stalemate in Congress. You talk about maybe everybody who works with the other side needs some kind of very large, invisible badge of honor, which unfortunately you never received. But there is, you know, you look at your service all of these years, nearly two-thirds of your life. And Senator Snow, there is, when I read your book, a sense of sadness about what's happened to the Senate, what's happened to the House, what's happened to people being cordial with each other, and what's happened to the whole process of democracy where you sit down and work things out and you have to give a little bit, but you're concerned about the common good. And I must say, I was depressed after I read how little emphasis there is on the common good.
Isn't that the truth? I mean, that the overriding interest should be for what is in the best interest of the country, ultimately. Everybody has differences, regardless whether it's in your personal or professional life, but you ultimately decide how you're going to transcend it, come up with a solution. And I'm a can-do person. I think America has always been a can-do country. And all of a sudden, we're in a position politically in Congress where we could not address any of the key overarching questions, especially over the last few years, which were paramount to our future and perilous to, you know, our economic well-being. And yet both sides stood down and no ability to transcend those differences.
Mm-hmm.
One thing to have you offer your position on either side, but when those positions don't prevail, you have to figure out, okay, how do you work it out, which in the past was the case. It wasn't as if we always had friendly discussions. Absolutely not. But there was never a question that we wouldn't solve the problem at hand. And we had fierce debates in the past. I mean, President Reagan and Tip O'Neill, you know, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, the Democratic House. But they worked together, even though they had the fierce differences and fierce debates. But that's the way it was. But ultimately, they knew they would come together for what was in, for the good of the country. And that's what's been lost, the purpose and the essence of public service. So I regret the reasons why I departed the Senate. But I felt so strongly about that issue, about the need to make sure that we don't make this political culture permanent, that there is another way. And we as citizens have got to do something about it. That's to take charge and reward bipartisanship.
Yeah, and we'll talk about how you think everybody should take charge, your recommendations, which are very interesting as we proceed this hour. Our guest is former United States Senator Olympia Snowe. Her book, Fighting for Common Ground, How We Can Fix the Stalemate in Congress. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We have many calls and emails coming, have already come in, and we'll take more. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Former Senator Olympia Snowe is our guest this hour. She says that the Senate, as well as the 112th Congress, whose term ended in January 2013, was no longer a legislative body where the key issues facing the country could be resolved. And she came to the sad conclusion that she could more effectively serve her country from outside the Senate than from within. And one of the ways she is serving her country now is by writing a book, and a good one it is. There are a lot of policy suggestions in this book. We'll get to them. Fighting for Common Ground, How We Can Fix the Stalemate in Congress. We go to phone calls, starting with Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen. Thank you and your team for yet another wonderful program. And Senator Snowe, thank you for your service.
Oh, you're very welcome.
My belief for a long time has been that one of the reasons that our elected officials in Washington, D.C. are held in such low esteem by so many of the voting public is the perception that this is the best Congress money can buy. But recently, I don't want to misattribute this, but I think it was Norm Ornstein talking about his new book, where he made, I think it was Norm, who made the claim that, or the observation, that in the past, time that was spent by Congress members working in committee and actually getting actual legislation through has now been replaced by dialing for dollars, contacting potential contributors, just trying to get enough money to pay for the next exceedingly expensive reelection campaign. Mm-hmm. And so that even the work of the Congress is now being impeded by this hunt for cash. And I guess what I'd like to ask you is, first of all, is that observation accurate to your knowledge? And secondly, could you just discuss the impact of money in the election process?
Thanks, Scott.
Yeah, thank you, Scott. And I mean, those are critical questions. And I don't disagree with Norm on the issue of raising money and how much it's consuming. The schedule in Washington on the part of lawmakers, given the levels that are being expended in every election, that only grows exponentially in the next election. We've seen that in hundreds of millions, and it is terrible. It's regrettable, frankly. And yes, a lot of time is consumed by that for different levels. I mean, you know, even the fact that, you know, chairman of the committees are required to, you know, raise X amount of dollars, you know, to be in those positions, frankly, is unfortunate. And, you know, I'd never had a leadership PAC in the United States Senate. I think I was one of five senators. And probably at least half of the House of Representatives have leadership PACs now, which is another level of giving to candidates as a political action committee, in addition to their own committees for reelection. But it's another level of time that's required to raise this kind of money, not to mention the time it takes away from your legislative duties. So absolutely it does take away time. Because we spent so little time in Washington in a given week, if you think about the enormity of the issues. Now, if you come back Monday night and have a vote, and by Thursday you're out, you know, going back to your district or your state or wherever, that leaves very few days in which to accomplish anything on a major scale, the issues that we're dealing with, let alone all the other competing demands of your time, which is raising money. And then, because they have events in Washington, calling, you know, making fundraising calls, and also, you know, obviously meeting with your constituents, doing press, whatever the case may be. So it's very little time. That's why I call for a 5-day work week. But getting back to the money issue, absolutely. And I think that the Supreme Court decision was horrific in terms of the impact of even unleashing more dollars, which means candidates have to raise more money. But you get all these attack ads. Mm-hmm. In fact, it was my provision in the Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, that was challenged and was not upheld. It was part of the McCain-Feingold on issue advocacy ads. And it was sustained in the first court challenge before the Supreme Court, but then with the departure of Sandra Day O'Connor, we lost the ability to have that sustained again, and we lost it. And then they unfolded another, you know, hundreds of millions with the decision they made and rolling back precedent in case law for 100 years, in addition to striking down my provision. So we have to do something about it. Campaign finance reform is critical because the amounts of money that are being spent, you know, is spewing invectives, flooding the airwaves. So, and that spews over to the legislative system. That means they have to raise more money because they're running against candidates as well as groups that are spending, you know, 75 times now.
Goodness.
What was spent 20 years ago.
Yeah. So how does Congress change that? How can Congress change that?
You know, that's a very important question and a difficult one, because the key now is how do you make some changes that will withstand constitutional challenges and scrutiny? And I've been working with some people who have come to me as well. What can we do on a national basis to work together? Because it has to be done on a bipartisan basis. Like McCain-Feingold, which was done by Senator John McCain and former Senator Russ Feingold, with whom I worked to incorporate what was called the Snow Jeffers provision that was struck down by the court in Citizens United. We worked together, but it was for many years to get that right balance between Democrats and Republicans, so both buy in. So we've got to figure out what can we do, but there's some things that can be done. I say abolish leadership PACs, for example, getting back to Scott's question. That's one level of fundraising that lawmakers wouldn't have to do. Frankly, if you ban leadership PACs, unless you're running for a position of leadership in Congress, then frankly, you shouldn't have to be raising another level of funding for contributions to your colleagues or to other candidates who are running for political office.
Pat from New Auburn asked this question. To what extent have the 24-hour so-called news channels changed the way Congress behaves or misbehaves?
Yeah, that has obviously contributed. I mean, obviously with the advocacy ads that are being run by outside groups, the 24/7 media, that obviously, you know, there's an insatiable demand for, you know, ratings and content. So there's greater pressures on media today to fill the airwaves. And so often now what happens is they invite people on programs that are either or, on one end of the political spectrum or the other, but not so much in between. And so people don't get the benefit, you know, of, well, what can we do to solve the problem? You only hear the, you know, the strong rhetoric in opposition or in support of something as opposed to how we can solve the problem. And you know, so you compound that with the ads that are running now perpetually, not just in the campaign cycle, but throughout the year, it adds to the polarization and the demonization of viewpoint. So it does contribute. And obviously, oftentimes, lawmakers will go on, you know, to make a point in 30 seconds. And so you don't get the perspective of how you can solve the problem.
Mm-hmm. And don't you read, the last election, Senator Snow, I almost wondered if we hadn't reached the point where people were just taking the money and throwing it out the window because we had had it with ads. The saturation was unbelievable.
It certainly was. I mean, I know just watching it, I mean, it was dizzying to see the degree. I agree with you. I think it has a counter effect.
Mm-hmm.
Really, and certainly doesn't do anything that enhances the campaign. It confuses people, it angers people, it frustrates them, and they turn it out. I don't know how many people I heard, whether it was in Maine or across the country when I was traveling, people would say, I've had it. Mm-hmm. You know, I've had it. I've turned the TV off. I refuse to listen to these ads anymore because they're so negative. And, you know, that's the truth of it. 71% of the ads that are run, they're negative. They're mm-hmm. attacking a candidate, not supporting a candidate. So that also enhances the divide in the political process.
Alan in Appleton, hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Thanks for your guests for being here. I read a quote this morning, and it just was like an aha moment. And it was something along the lines of, when you elect people that tell you that government cannot work for you, they're obligated to prove that. And thinking about what's going on right now and how things work, it sure seems like that is the case. And I'll take your response off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan.
Yes, so that they're obligated to prove that it isn't working?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which, you know, we need to make sure that we can demonstrate to the American people that we know how to solve problems and that the government does work. And frankly, you know, I always think about President Reagan. You know, he supported a limited government, but he supported one that was effective and efficient, not one that, you know, simply was eviscerated. And I think that's the point, because obviously government does have a role to play in our lives, and the question is to the degree and how. And so I think it is critically important that we demonstrate, you know, how government can perform. And unfortunately today, as we're seeing with the polls, you know, people lack trust, and you can understand why, frankly, about the way in which Congress is performing, in which now our governmental agencies, when we see what's happening in the IRS. So I think it is important that the only way that can change is how lawmakers come together to work in what's in the best interest of the country.
Well, I want to know how things are going to change, because you write, and I think the American public and where politicians are very much at odds. You probably agree. But you write the 112th Congress was almost, this is a huge statement, Senator Snow, was almost universally derided as the worst ever, the most polarized body since the end of Reconstruction. That's quite a statement. Things can't continue along those lines or nothing will get done.
Exactly. You know, that polarization statistic was underscored in a study that was conducted by three political scientists. Wasn't that, I mean, to say in 134 years we're now more right. polarized than any other moment? I mean, that's, you know, saying a lot. And the second part of it is on worst Congress ever. I'm thinking about, and there was a previous question talking about Norm Ornstein. He said in his column, you know, people always say this is the worst Congress ever. He said this time they're right. I mean, that was the unfortunate part of all of that. It is an major statement. And yet, you know, what's interesting, it didn't rattle enough Congress to do something about it. I mean, that's what was so, I think, devastating in many ways and disheartening to Americans, that here we couldn't rise to the moment. I look at the potential of our institutions. Our institutions have tremendous capacity to solve problems, you know, if people within it are prepared to do so. And when we have the toughest problems is when we should reach the highest levels of aspirations to achieve, you know, what's right for the, you know, the best interest of this country, to do what's right. That's what's expected of us. And that's what I think was so disenchanting about the direction taken. And that was the realization that set in on me. As I was traveling Maine and across the country, I realized when people would say to me, how's it going to change and what will make it change? How will it change? And I started to think about that, and I realized the change has to come from the outside, from, you know, Americans demanding bipartisanship, because it takes courage today to participate in developing a solution.
Right. So tell me a bit about the Bipartisan Policy Center, about Olympia's List, the organizations you're working with from the outside.
Yes, you know, and that's why I think it's important, you know, not only to state the problem, some of the things we can do, because I want people to realize, you know, we're not talking about eternity here to solve the problems. We can do here and now, real time, because of social media, what the polarizing forces have done, you know, and the political class will have you think, oh, you know, you can't do anything about it, you know, we can't bridge the divide. Yes, you can, and we can demand it. Today they were citing Chris Christie, how popular he is in New Jersey, for example.
Mm-hmm.
He's being rewarded for his bipartisanship because people understand you have to solve problems. That's why I joined the Bipartisan Policy Center, which is interesting, Kathleen. It was co-founded by four former U.S. Senate majority leaders, two Democrats and two Republicans. Senator Mitchell, Senator Daschle, Senator Baker, and Senator Dole. And we've got a Common Ground project, and I urge people to go to bipartisanpolicy.org, because we found a new Common Ground project to galvanize a new citizens movement, to rally in real time people who want to weigh in now, currently, what's happening in Congress, what we can do to break the stalemate, reward lawmakers who are willing to find the Common Ground options. And Olympia's List, and I have olympiaslist.org, is I've founded a PAC, a political action committee, to help consensus candidates who bridge the divide, who are willing to work on a bipartisan basis, whether they're candidates or reelecting lawmakers, and both Democrats and Republicans, because I think that's the only way we're going to change this, to get people in there who, you know, want to work on a bipartisan basis. In addition to open primaries and redistricting commissions, we've got to get independent redistricting commissions so we don't have the kind of gerrymandered districts that have occurred in the House of Representatives, where we have very few competitive seats. In fact, according to two studies, either 21 or 35 seats out of 435 are actually competitive.
Oh, my goodness, really?
Isn't that unbelievable?
It is amazing. Rick in Elkhart, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And Senator Snow, I just want to tell you I have a lot of respect for you. I follow politics some, and I'm really on the other side, more of a social Democrat, but I really appreciate what you tried to do.
Thank you.
In Congress. Anyway, I think part that still bothers me about the bailout, et cetera, was how did they possibly think it was a good idea to bail out the big guys and leave the little person to flounder? How could they? and then no one goes to jail. The common guy gets arrested for shoplifting, but no one's gone to jail. I just think we feel left out of the equation, the little guy. And I think that's what fueled a lot of the Tea Party anger and resentment. It just hit people in their stomachs. It just, wow, what has happened here? It's just a government of the big guys for protection of the big guys. How they ever thought in Congress that was a good idea, I just don't know. Can you shed some light on that for me?
Yes, you know, you're not alone in that feeling, I know, in talking to people. And even in the polls today reflecting that, you know, 68% of American people think in the economy what's happening now is benefiting corporations and wealthy, and only 21% think it's benefiting everybody. And so I think that's regrettable. I've always felt that Congress, and Washington was sort of detached from the real world of the average Americans. That's why I was arguing for changes. And on the bailout, it was a very difficult question, frankly. To find ourselves in a situation where we had to provide this kind of support for the big institutions that put us in this position, it was really ultimately a tough choice, either because you'd end up, you know, leading to a depression and potentially a run on all the banks in the country, or not, and taking that risk. And I didn't think we could afford to take that risk for the country. So we really had little choice in how I viewed it. But then the next step should have occurred on the prosecution. I mean, I agree with you on that. In fact, argued for that to be included in a plan at the time, because I thought that that was absolute. And they put language in there, but it wasn't sufficient and tough enough. In fact, Senator Wyden and I worked on issues just on the compensation question in the aftermath of all that. So making sure that executives were not getting these kind of compensation packages we heard about at times when they were getting help from the government. So, yes, there is that detachment. And then the further, situation that occurred is that beyond the stimulus, we didn't address helping the average person, the small business. And that's where I think that the huge vacuum occurred. You're absolutely right. That ultimately galvanized movements such as the Tea Party and even Occupy Wall Street, because they saw, that disconnect between Washington and the real world on Main Street in the small communities,
yes,
and average households. And I talked about that a lot, because that was part of my frustration, is that we weren't seeing that there was this huge divide and we had not done the rest of our job. And so you're absolutely right. And that's still true to this day. And focusing on the economy, the detachment, you can say about, that's great, the Dow's going up and so on, but still, if you look at Main Street and the average households, they need help. We need to be focusing on job creation and economic growth. It is not where it should be. This isn't what we should accept. This isn't as good as it gets for America. That's why tax reform, regulatory reform, which I've been arguing for, should be done.
Thanks so much, Rick, for your call. Former Senator Olympia Snowe is our guest this hour. Her book, well worth a read. It's very well written and lot of interesting ideas. Fighting for Common Ground, How We Can Fix the Stalemate in Congress. She served in the U.S. Congress for 34 years, three-term senator from Maine, elected to the State House of Representatives in 73 at the age of 26, the Maine Senate in 1976, representing Maine's second congressional district in the U.S. House from 79 to 95 before being elected to the U.S. Senate. She, in exploring her reelection campaign in 2012, had some very serious thoughts about whether or not she could do this again, and she came to the conclusion that it was time for her to leave and to serve her country from the outside rather than from within. She is now, in addition to writing and speaking widely, she's a senior fellow at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and she also founded Olympia's List. It recognizes and supports elected officials and candidates who demonstrate their commitment to solving our nation's problems. More phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls for Senator Olympia Snowe, Buck in Madison is next. Hi, Buck.
Hello, Olympia Snowe.
Hi,
I really admire you. I'm a lefty in Wisconsin, and we have our problems with reactionaries who have been bought by ALEC. So my question is, how does the conservative half of our political discourse cure itself?
Well, you know, I find it interesting because I look at the Republican Party from the time, you know, I've been a lifelong Republican and I've seen the changes. Regrettably, I mean, I think that the traditional principles of the Republican Party, which ones that I've espoused, of limited government, strong national defense, and individual freedom and opportunity, are ones that, you know, we should embrace and focus on, as opposed to some of the more, you know, more social, obviously on the social issues, but also on the more extreme issues of the way in which they have been enunciated. Frankly, I've always viewed in the Republican Party is that we've got to be tolerant of diverse viewpoints and inclusive and not exclusive. And my experience had been throughout the years, for the most part, is that it had been inclusive, that we understood that there were differences and appreciated those differences. But like President Reagan used to say, we'll focus on what we agree on and, you know, and leave the others where we disagree, set them aside. But unfortunately, that hasn't been true today. And I think that's why I think that the party is going through this introspective moment and have to try to sort out how they're going to be a governing majority in the future, which is going to have to really change in the way in which not only do they approach issues, but what are their positions on key policies that will appeal to a broader segment of the population. It wasn't as if we wouldn't have conservative, moderate, and liberals within the Republican Party. It's the question how we would work with one another under one tent. But that isn't the case today in the way in which they view, for example, moderate Republicans. And if you can't appeal to those who are already Republicans within the party, then how do you expect to appeal to those outside of the party? And so we should really go back to our traditional principles, work together in those areas in which we agree.
We're spending so much time, and you outlined this, it must have been very sad and difficult for you to see the people you call your outstanding colleagues having their distinguished careers derailed by a tightly organized subgroup within the main Republican Party. You also blame the Democrats for spending huge amounts of money to defeat someone like Senator Blanche Lincoln. There have been some rough elections, haven't there?
Yes, and you know, it's interesting. And certainly on the Republican side, I've been focusing in primaries in the past and defeated people, you know, for example, Senator Lugar, who's been, you know, made extraordinary contributions to this country for multi-decades of exemplary public service. And we lost Senator Bob Bennett, for example, out in Utah, another example of what went awry. Mike Castle, you know, in Delaware, another outstanding public servant, you know, moderate Republican who was both a governor and a congressman for many years and was defeated in a primary, you know, by a Tea Party candidate. So that is regrettable, absolutely. And then on the Democrat side, I cite Blanche Lincoln, who was, you know, targeted many millions within a primary. So you're losing the middle in the political system, in the institution of the United States Senate, frankly. There used to be a time where, you know, the National Journal did a survey starting back in 1982 that you had 58 senators who came between the most conservative Democrat and the most liberal Republican, and today, for the third year in a row, fourth time ever, there are zero senators that come between in that category.
And yet people like you, you've heard all of our listeners, whatever their political viewpoint, saying, congratulations, we really like you, we really champion who you are. I mean, there's kind of a big disconnect here, isn't there?
You got it. Absolutely. And in fact, that's what I discovered traveling. I said, well, you know what? It isn't as the country isn't as divided as, you know, as they say, the polarizing forces in the political class would have you believe. They aren't. You're absolutely right. They're given little choices now because the primaries, the way in which the primaries function in this country, you have people on either side of the ideological spectrum. You don't have, you know, broader, more centrist candidates emerging from primaries, so people don't have a choice. That's what I discovered, is that people aren't as divided. Yes, you have people on the far right and the far left, but most people are in the middle, and most people want their government to work.
Right.
I heard that over and over again. And I think people try to define us through MSNBC or Fox News. That's why I used to say they used to define me, the either or. The people aren't in that category. You know, yes, there are some that view, want to watch their Fox News or MSNBC, but the key is people understand that you're going to have to compromise to get things done, and that compromise isn't a dirty word. And frankly, we got to get back to that, because I don't know any other way to solve a problem. You can't solve your problems in your personal life if you don't compromise, or in any sphere of professional life. And yeah, that's true. And we have to work with one another, and that's what it's all about in the final analysis. And that has to be true in the political sphere as well. We have to get back. That's how our country became the United States of America. Our founding fathers had to compromise to get it done.
And when you think about the different viewpoints they had, they were pretty wildly divergent, weren't they, on many issues?
They sure were. Yeah. They were, let's just say they weren't shrinking violets.
No, they weren't. Buck, thanks for the call. Debbie in Stevens Point, hi.
Hello, Senator Snow. Thank you so much for your service. And I would just like to say that I think you are a pioneer for women to get into politics.
Thank you.
And I would just like to hear your thoughts on campaign finance reform and term limits to maybe help fix this problem.
Yes, on the campaign finance reform, I think we need to do something on campaign finance reform again. I mean, as I said, I worked on the McCain-Feingold and had the issue of advocacy and lost that provision in the Supreme Court and Citizens United. The key now is whether or not you can get both sides to come together, because that's what it's going to require. For anything to happen, you have to have balance that neither, you know, disadvantages one side over the other or advantages one side over the other. You have to have both at the table. But the second part of it is withstanding constitutional scrutiny now, given what happened in Citizens United, which was a regrettable, unfortunate decision by the Supreme Court, frankly. So I think that, you know, I'm going to be working with some people on this question on a national basis. We're talking about it at the Bipartisan Policy Center as well. Some people have approached us. So hopefully we can do that. The key is, how do you withstand that? Does it require a constitutional amendment? Can you do that? I mean, that's also a difficult road as well. But something has to change. And frankly, it's this whole issue of outside organizations, the amount of money that's spent. I wanted transparency and have them, you know, have to be like political action committees, not just unleashing unlimited dollars, you know, in the system, and then say they're not attempting to influence the outcome of an election. Obviously, they are.
Thanks, Debbie, for the call. Pat in Richland Center. Hi, Pat.
Hey, good morning. You know what? We know that the vast majority of American people want to see their tax dollars go to meet the needs of fellow Americans, particularly, you know, at the bottom and in the middle, you know, reduce suffering. And every time a president takes that serious like Barack, you know, then there's just like this major gridlock, can't get anything done. However, if you want some really good bipartisan support, go back a few years and let's start a war of choice in Iraq that's totally unethical and immoral. And do you regret your vote on that, Senator Snow? And in retrospect, how big of a mistake was that invasion of Iraq that's caused all this unnecessary suffering?
Well, obviously, if we knew then what we know now on the weapons of mass destruction, it would have been obviously a different decision. But it was on the question of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And obviously, we discovered there weren't any. 20 years ago, during the time when President Bush 41, you know, repelled the invasion, of Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, we were very much surprised about the degree to which they had been developing a capacity. Obviously, it was an entirely different situation and scenario when we went into Iraq in 2003. On the basis of weapons of mass destruction, obviously, that wasn't the case. So that was unfortunate. You know, as one is, you know, examined that question and what should have been done differently and what went wrong, that we didn't have that information, that accuracy based on making that kind of, which is monumental decision. It's most serious, difficult, critical question a lawmaker can make, and certainly the president. Yes, I mean, it would have been different if we had known the situation at the time.
Thank you so much, Pat, for the call. Senator Snow, it's been just delightful speaking with you, and I hope a lot of people read the book. It's a book of great substance, as you are as well. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, our pleasure. Our guest this hour, Senator Olympia Snow, former U.S. Senator, and the book that she has just written is Fighting for Common Ground, How We Can Fix the Stalemate in Congress. I'll repeat what Bob Schieffer, like Bob Schieffer said on March 4, 2012, after she said she would not seek reelection. What does it say about the state of our government and politics when serious people like Olympia Snow conclude that serving in the U.S. Senate is no longer worth their time and effort? That's the part that should worry the rest of us. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley for producing this program. Thanks for all of your calls. Great conversations ahead, and we'll be with you to talk about the cost of health care, one of our topics, tomorrow.